Dustin Russo, CFAM for the UN Minute. For more information, go to c-fam.org.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest on Church and Culture today has been on several times before. Professor Frank Buckley is the foundation professor at George Mason School of Law in Arlington, Virginia. And he's been on previously to talk about two of his previous books, the most recent being The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America and Counterbooks this year. And as I said then, The Way Back, Restoring Promise of America, is the best book on American politics and really the practicality of restoring America's future that I've read in memory. So, Frank Buckley, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thanks very much for having me, but I hope you don't mind. I have to correct you. You said I was a professor at George Mason Law School, and I'm not. I'm a professor at Scalia Law School at George Mason University.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Pardon me. Forgive me.
Sure. We got some money.
Okay. Well, that's a good name. I'm not going to say it's a better name because of the, you know, venerable name of George Mason, but it's certainly a great name. Frank, we're living in such a crazy time. You know, it's so multi-layered. I mean, I remember Hermann Hesse in his novel Steppenwolf, you know, described the human soul as kind of layers of an onion. And it seems like to get any kind of grip on the culture, not just in this country, but around the world, it's almost like you have to go skin by skin. So if you were going to begin at the outer skin to try to make some sense of, and of course I'm talking about terrorism, and I'm talking about this presidential election, I'm talking about a president who, for the first time in history, is becoming an active participant in his party's nominee's campaign. I'm talking about the lack of responsibility that's being demanded of the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, regarding her obvious cover-up of her emails with classified information. I'm talking about the reaction of overseas heads of state to this election and what they're saying, especially the Prime Minister of France a few days ago. Where do you start, Frank?
Well, you gave me quite a list, didn't you? Maybe I could start not at the outer, but at the inner layer. I'm here in Alexandria looking across the river. I can see the federal buildings. I can see the Capitol. And at the inner layer, I would have said the problem is that there is an entire disconnect between, you know, what might be called an establishment in America and at least one's image of ordinary Americans. There seems to be a crisis of faith in what America means to people. I'm not worried about, you know, Francis Hollande in France. I'm not worried about foreign leaders. I'm more interested in ordinary Americans. And Trump's appeal, I think, has been that he's appealed to those instincts, to our idea of America as the greatest country in the world, a country whose greatness has been tarnished and which we want to recover. That appeals to a whole bunch of people. And I guess the opponent for those people is a somewhat corrupt Washington, which is comfortable in a society which is very, very good for people at the top, but not really very good for everyone else. Now I'd say it's a question of faith more than anything, and what America means.
That sounds like the, I don't know, you could call it the outer or the inner, because it's the big picture of the thing. And why is it then that Hillary Clinton, who is, you know, clearly part of the group of elite Democrats, and will include the mainstream media in this, who is pushing this American guilt meme, the American responsibility for terrorism, and so forth. How do you explain her appeal?
Well, it's a very different Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Party of 50, 60, 70 years ago was a very different animal, and a very admirable animal, too. I mean, the ideals of the Democrats in the 50s and the 60s were, under John Kennedy, were really quite admirable. I mean, this was the country that was, this was the party that was opposed to bigotry, opposed to discrimination, that was forward-looking, that had confidence in America. And now there's been a complete transvaluation of values. What has happened is the party of all lives matter has become the party of only some lives matter. And it became a pastiche of the old Roosevelt coalition. I mean, the Dems always did coalitions of different groups, but now it's all coalition. It's all separate groups united against America, right? It's a party that exists only to divide people. It's blacks against white, men against women, gays against straight. And it milks resentment, and it's also the creature of a horrible educational system that teaches kids how terrible the country is. You know, you kind of wonder, golly, what has happened to the traditional American love for one's country and respect for its traditions and pride in the country? I mean, has that been so entirely replaced by guilt? And that was your question. I don't know the answer. I don't think that that's the case, but I can see how many of our political and religious institutions, educational institutions, even religious institutions, have been preaching that there's something radically wrong with America. And these were minor voices. These were voices out of the mainstream in the 60s, and now they've gone mainstream.
Yeah, all those people that you and I fought during our college and graduate school years and then our teaching years, the books we've written, the articles we've published, the lectures we've given, they've won. I mean, they own the academy, lock, stock, and barrel. They own the media for the most part. They're at the heads of the major foundations that give money away to people like us, especially people in the academy, and they're in charge, and they are pushing their agenda with a supreme intolerance, the same intolerance that they continue to charge conservatives and people of earnest faith with. It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really ironic. They preached tolerance when they were in the minority, and now when they're in the majority, they preach intolerance. Someone, I think it might have been Irving Kristol, said the cultural wars are over, we lost. And there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, I don't think any cause is ever lost.
Forever.
For whatever reason anybody should ever give up. But if we're a different country, that's part of the reason.
You know, I look at, my daughter is 28, and it's one way I stay in touch with the culture. My son's 19, too, and it seems as if, and I think it's something to be happy about, that they're disconnected from both parties. And they don't buy the second phase feminism pushed by Hillary and her friends. They don't really buy the culture wars issue. It seems as if they've almost decided they're just going to make up their own minds and start over based upon whatever evidence they recognize.
I like that. I mean, that's about as good as it gets. You know, part of the problem has been a Republican Party that seemingly in many ways is complicit with all of the bad stuff going on. I mean, it has been very plugged into special interests, notably at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with respect to things like mass immigration. And of course, they're squealing now at Donald Trump. I mean, it seems to me that with all his flaws and with all of the tweets he gives us, he nevertheless represents a voice that many Americans take to be authentically American and representing what they want in the country. I think that's great. I support the fellow. I support Trump. But more importantly, what I really would want to see recovered is the classic idea of America that one had when one was a child. You know, the greatest country in the world, the country that did great things, the country that licked diseases, sent a man to the moon, upheld noble causes. I mean, that's the America that we want, right?
And that's the America that still predominates, I think, in the memory of most Americans. And therefore, that surge of populist support for Donald Trump. Yet he seems to want to engage in arguments, public arguments, with people that doesn't really help him to do that.
Yeah, well, that's pretty obvious. If you take his cell phone away from him, I think there are probably a lot of people at Trump Tower who would want to do exactly that.
Well, you know, it's funny because we Catholics post these articles about our Holy Father on the airplane, and we kind of say, keep him away from the press or keep him off airplanes. And I had somebody remark, and take away Donald Trump's tweet, Twitter account. I thought that was very funny.
I mean, this is a digression, but can I give you my 30-second take on the Pope?
Yes.
I think people who are not Catholics, and many Catholics as well, tend to see the world only in political terms. And so they evaluate the Pope on the basis of his political statements.
Or the statements that have political ramifications.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. But if you, that's a better way of putting it. But if you look at it from another perspective, of a perspective not of politics on a right-left axis, but of sanctity, then you recognize the man's holiness. I mean, this is a guy, I think, destined for sainthood. So when he says, for example, and this is, a lot of evangelicals got upset over this, when he says that, you know, Catholics don't have standing to criticize Islam because of the sins of Catholics, he's speaking to people reared with traditional ideas of guilt. I mean, he's speaking to Catholics about their own sins, which is what a pastor does, at least old time. So I see him more as a very traditional pastor of, you know, Catholicism when I was growing up, where politics really didn't much enter into it. And everyone who sees it solely in terms of politics is basically confessing the limitation of their worldview.
Okay, well, let me defend those Catholics for a second, because I think we want to tease this out a little more. That's why I restated the concern about ramifications. And are you then saying that the Pope really shouldn't be not held responsible, is a bad word, bad way to put it, but should we assume that the Pope doesn't really care about the political ramifications, if there are any, of what he says?
He does seem to be a bit of an innocent in some respects in some of the things he says. But the basic message I see is one almost shorn of political ramifications in his mind. It's not intended.
Yes, in his mind. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. It's not intended to have political ramifications. Rather, it's intended, I think, as a message to Catholics to repent and to recognize their own sins. And that's such a radical thing to say nowadays that I think many people miss it. But what he said, for example, this is on the plane, I think, what he said is, well, you know, they asked me, is Islam intrinsically violent? And I read the paper in Italy, and I see this Catholic has done that, and that Catholic has done that. They're all Catholics. And I say, roughly, do I have, you know, are we permitted to criticize the other religion? And he said, no. And the point is, that was a message not to Islam, and it was not a message to Protestants. It was a message to Catholics. Tend your own garden. And that's...
Tend your own soul.
That's exactly pretty much what a priest would have said 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? You know,
I think that's very well said, Frank.
Old-fashioned Catholic guilt.
Yeah. Talking with Frank Buckley, who is Foundation Professor of the Scalia Law School of...
Thank you.
George Mason University. And speaking of Scalia, Republican nominee Donald Trump continues to say on the stump that he will nominate justices to the Supreme Court in the mold of Antonin Scalia. What exactly does that mean, Frank?
Well, he gave a list of judges.
Were you on it?
No.
Not even close.
But these were all people who were vetted by conservative organizations in town, and they were, you know, people instantly said, oh, this is just a great list. And you know, for many people amongst the people who dislike Trump, this is a reason to support him, and I think that's very valid. Consider the alternative. The alternative with Hillary would be an utterly transformed America. I mean, we saw the beginnings of this with Obama, but it really didn't come to fruition. One of the reasons for that was, you know, a somewhat conservative Supreme Court, now split. I'll give you one example of why it matters. On immigration, the president's immigration plan to admit about 4 or 5 million illegals was struck down by the Fifth Circuit and went up to the Supreme Court, which split 4-4, which basically reinstated the Fifth Circuit opinion. You know, the four people who would have upheld Obama's plan essentially were voting for something like a quasi-monarchy, right, where the president holds all the power. With a Hillary presidency, you have to assume that would become the law of the land, that Hillary could do whatever she wanted, that she couldn't rule through Congress, right, because she'd never get along with anyone. But she'd rule by executive decree, and that's all she
needed. Okay, and there you go. Now, you're an expert on the Constitution, and you studied it backwards and forwards from the founding to the present. Give us a little lesson on executive orders and what are their proper use and what are their improper uses?
Well, if Congress passes a law, there are going to be a lot of cases where the exact ramifications are not fully spelled out, and those are cases where the president can flesh things out with an executive order or even, you know, just a simple memorandum. There are also cases of things which are intrinsically part of the executive branch's authority where the president can make those kinds of rulings. For example, the president is commander-in-chief, and as commander-in-chief has power with respect to tactics and strategy, day-to-day operations of military, which Congress can't have. I mean, it's just not the case that Congress can run a war. What, however, about the decision, the prior decision to send military troops abroad? Does that require a declaration of war through Congress. And I think the framers would have said, well, yeah, of course, the last thing we'd want is one person who could decide on his own whether or not we go to war with somebody else. So we'd want a declaration of war in those cases. Donald Trump, about a week ago, said that he wants a declaration of war against ISIS. I think that's entirely proper. That would have the effect of tending to restore the power of Congress, which is sorely wanting these days. Hillary said, we don't need that. Right. So that's an example of how the distinction between that which is intrinsic to the executive branch and that which requires consent of Congress.
Well, what about
Congress is totally ignored.
It's said, at least in passing, that President George W. Bush was responsible in part for increasing the latitude of executive orders, and that President Obama really has not gone further than Bush did. Is that true?
No, not at all. Obama has gone much further than George Bush has. This was something that the left complained about, Bush's executive orders, back in the aughts, back during the Bush administration. And, you know, the Elizabeth Drews of the world said, oh, this is basically fascism. Well, you know, there are a bunch of people on the left who see fascism every time they see a Republican. That's just nonsense. Bush, what upset people about Bush was his assertion of executive authority with regard to controversial methods of interrogation, which were subsequently struck down by the Supreme Court. But, you know, that's an issue on which it seems to me is more properly a question of executive authority than something Congress should be looking at. That said, I think what the Bush administration did was prime stupidity, all right, both in terms of trying to, create to nation build in Iraq. I think that was madness. I was dead. And the way that the interrogations were handled was absolutely shameful. And that did so much to discredit the Republican brand. I mean, there are so many ways in which the Republican brand itself is just terrible these days. Right? I mean, the Bush War on Terror, the interrogation techniques, a class of crony capitalists in D.C., a Republican Party all too willing to play footsie with them, the openness with respect to open borders, all of those things which set the Republican elite apart from ordinary Americans have made most Americans furious at the Republican Party. I mean, that's part of Trump's appeal. I mean, that is Trump's appeal. So, full marks to him for that.
Is he going to survive the media? I mean, it appears to me that the media has completely dropped any pretense of being journalists. Yep. It's as if they're all now paid consultants and paid surrogates for the Democratic Party. And I, yep. Like, for example, there's an article this morning from ABC saying that Donald Trump is considering withdrawing from the campaign. And I know you know that that's complete hogwash.
It is complete hogwash. It is complete hogwash. But it's something that, somehow the Never Trump people didn't die and go away. Not only did they not go away, they are more furious than ever. They're absolutely mad. People like Yuval Levin, Eric Erickson are anathematizing all of the people who are still pro-Trump. Well, you know, that's fine. My attitude is sayonara. I mean, I don't worry about that one bit. But I find their anger just really extraordinary. So you got all these stories getting out there, and the press at this point no longer believes that its duty is to report the news. The press believes that its duty is to convey a moral message. We knew, in this town, it's all about the Washington Post, as you know. So if you recall how starting a couple of years back, you couldn't pick up the Post without a front page story about some persecuted gays. It was the same kind of thing. That was a great moral issue of our time, the Post thought. And now it's transgender people, right? I mean, if somehow there isn't a story in the front page about some transgender person, you know, you have to ask yourself, my God, what happened? And that's their approach to politics generally. It's newspaper writing at the level of high school newspapers.
It's not even that good. At least in the high school newspapers, the teacher who oversees it demands some sort of honesty and integrity.
Yeah.
Or it won't get published.
Well, the adults are out of the room. it's really remarkable. I mean, you know, it's a revolutionary situation in some respects in that, you know, you desperately want new institutions and new voices. You have these groups that performed a useful service 25, 30 years back, and now they're absolutely useless. You know, in business, there's a kind of trajectory for a small firm. You start with a guy who built it up, and maybe he had dirt under his fingernails, but by God, the man had a big heart. And then you got the sons for the fancy pants MBAs, and the kids, the grandchildren on Ritalin, and so it goes upwards, and then it crests, and then it descends. And that's kind of a story of all the think tanks and all the magazines in town, right? They had their great eras in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and now they're simply a shadow of their former selves, right? They're not doing very much. They're taking up a lot of donor money is what they're doing. I mean, the three major think tanks in town, $200 million a year, right, which is basically, for the most part, thrown out the window, I think. But they're really good at development, right? I mean, what has happened to a lot of magazines and to all the think tanks is that the brains have gone out the window, and they're just money-making development organizations. And you know, some of the developers are great guys, but, you know, it's just a machine that keeps on going, but the message isn't there anymore.
I'm talking with Professor Frank Buckley of the Scalia Law School at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia. He lives in Alexandria, and he's knows a lot about what's going on in this presidential campaign from the inside. We'll be back with Frank Buckley after this short message.
Ave Maria Radio is at the Woodward Dream Cruise again this year. Join the audience when Catholic Connection and Cresta in the Afternoon are broadcast live from the Shrine of the Little Flower on August 19th. Then, on August 20th, the day of the cruise, we invite you to join us at the Catholic Corner at 12 Mile and Woodward in front of the Tower of the National Shrine of the Little Flower, the best place to see the cruise. Join the fun at the Beer, Brats, and Barbecue Bonanza at the Basilica while watching the largest rolling car show on Earth. We'll see you there.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shields, on a recent self-discovery of how anyone can subtly help those seeking help from the church.
One of the things I've found out in this era of the new evangelization is how many people are coming into our parishes during Mass, and they're curious, but they don't know what to do. And I've just been realizing that if I pray and say, Lord, lead me to the person who most needs you, it's as though God is preparing the way, and we have a place where we need to take some initiative. So I want to say to all our listeners, pray when you go to church. Don't just go to your comfortable place and sit down. Pray when you go in, Lord, if you need me, I am available to you. Show me who you want me to talk to. And if there is, God will have somebody come up to you, or you'll look at somebody's face and just say, I ought to go over and introduce myself. You know, we can do that. It's not that hard. I've gone over to people and just said, hello, my name is, and I haven't seen you before. Inevitably, no, I've never been here before, and this is what's going on in my life, and can you get me help?
Sister Ann Shields gives you food for the journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 10 a.m. on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
I am back with Professor Frank Buckley of the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, and once again I want to mention his most recent book, which is, again, it's the best book I've read ever, or at least in my memory, of what needs to be done to bring America back, restoring the promise of America. It's called The Way Back, the Restoring the Promise of America. And Frank, I think since I'm saying that, we need to take a few minutes at least and go back to your book. We had an interview about that about a month ago. And in this book, and you're a known conservative professor, writer, you underscored the issue of wealth distribution and of social mobility, social and economic mobility, saying basically that America has become a place where wealth distribution is very unequal, historically unequal from the top to the bottom, and that because of various factors, including education, the opportunity to move upward on economic and social scale is at a historic low, but very, very low, and this needs to be changed. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. I mean, what it comes down to is this. I think many conservatives, many Republicans forgot that politics is really about people. What they thought it was about was some kind of political geometry where you just get the right set of rules and let it rip. And you don't care how things work out for people. But when you step back and you look at how things did work out, what you discover is they worked out really well for people at the top of the game, but everybody else was left behind. And that what had happened was the idea of America, that this is a country where everybody can get ahead, that just wasn't true. We've become pretty immobile. And American voters realize this, right? When they're polled, they say they no longer think their kids will have it as well off as they do. And I think that explains the 2012 election, right? I mean, people had the sense that, at least Obama promised to do something about it, whereas Mitt Romney came across as the guy who wanted to give you the pink slip. I mean, he just came across as heartless. And there's kind of a heartless element amongst Republican ideologues, conservative ideologues. I mean, these are the people who in many respects have a dominant voice in the party. Some of them are Randist. Many of them are influenced by Rand, like Speaker Paul Ryan. They believe in abstract principles of right, Lockean principles, and they don't look at how things worked out. But Americans who see how things worked out don't like those principles. Right? Or they don't like the consequences of those principles. And what I wanted to say was, in these cases, believe the ordinary American voter who's smarter than our elites, and they know there's a problem. And the way back involves fixing the problem. And what makes the Republican elite doubly stupid is not only does he ignore ordinary people, but he's too darn stupid to realize that the way back involves undoing all the barriers which the left has erected, right? I mean, if we've got a problem about people moving ahead, it's because we've got a terrible immigration system. We've got a terrible educational system. So all those things, you look to the government to fix, to make you better off. The government has ignored us. And here's another poll finding, which is really, really significant. Only 19% of Americans think that the government, federal government, can be trusted. Ask yourself this. What is politics like if you live in a country where nobody trusts the government? It's a revolutionary situation. It's where we are.
It is, and but I want to dig one, you know, one shovelful deeper on this. I'm hearing more and more about the phrase white privilege, and I'm starting to see the word privilege work itself into things like literary criticism and just general culture critiques. If I was in the academy right now, I'd be fighting that, not because there isn't some truth to the issue of privilege and the accident of birth, but that I don't think anyone should be held as guilty for being born to whomever set of parents conceived them. How do you deconstruct this issue of white privilege?
Well, mostly I think it's just rank hypocrisy. It is a charge that is levied by those factories of hate, which are American universities, by the children of privilege themselves. And it's asserted typically by an ultra-privileged child of white liberals against, white Americans.
Conservatives.
Are not privileged in any way. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, the hypocrisy is absolutely contemptible. But there's one other thing, and that is, I am sickened by people who wanted to divide Americans, one set against the other. So the people who say that black lives and only black lives matter seem to me to be moral idiots. And the people who complain about white privilege are pretty much in the same category with a dash of hypocrisy added there, too. I think we should start by saying, no, we're all Americans, right? And nobody should divide us, right? We should, we shouldn't be talking about one set versus another. That's certainly what the Democratic Party does, but let's talk about something that makes all Americans better off.
I'm getting, frankly, very annoyed, not angered yet, but annoyed, at the assumption that I, as a white male of a certain age, has to be taught how to be, to lose my prejudice, to lose my, my arrogance, to that I need sensitivity training automatically. I mean, just people don't even know me. They just know my, it's two or three generic facts about me, and that immediately lumps me in this this pool of racist and elitist snobs. Now, I was reading yesterday about a young man who was on a student government in Midwest College, who objected to the Black Lives Matter meme and substituted the white All People Matter meme, and was immediately suspended from student government for 50 days, forced to apologize, had to go to three cultural events of featuring diversity, and had to go through sensitivity training just to return to student government. What is going on?
Yeah, you're from Texas. That was the University of Houston, man. I mean,
that's right. It was Houston.
Have we lost Texas?
Well, we've lost Houston.
We lost Houston.
But and it's like what Clint Eastwood said yesterday. I won't quote him.
Yeah.
But he's exactly right. I mean, this we have become wimps. That's my word for what he said. And
Dale, we understand.
Yeah, but how do we turn it around? How do we stop it?
I think one way of doing of stopping is to note the charge is not meant to be one against which you can defend yourself, because even if they don't catch you out saying horrible things like "I like America," they can accuse you of unconscious racism. And the roots of this is Marxist false consciousness. In other words, you're guilty of bad thoughts, okay, even if you don't know you have them. It's right out of 1984. It's complete thought control, It's the absolute abolition of any distinction between the political and the private. And it's ultimately really terrifying because it invades, you know, the most private space of all, your private conscience. But of course, you know, people on the left don't believe in private conscience anymore. They think that, you know, Catholics should be forced to adhere to the new national religion of liberalism. And you know, and to the extent that you have any qualms about this, there's something deeply wrong with you, and you you should be condemned. It's ultimately a form of the deepest kind of fascism.
Yes, fascism. I noticed that the Black Lives Matter crowd feels free to violently and physically shut down gatherings to attack Trump supporters if they're in public. And this does remind me of the jackboots.
Yeah. In a way, I don't blame the Black Lives Matter people because, number one, they're, you know, many of them are on the receiving end of dollars from liberal donors. But in a way, it also reminds me of Putin and Russian foreign policy, which is based on administering bitch slaps to Obama. When you find yourself dealing with somebody who's naturally very weak, there is in our human makeup a desire to take advantage on such a person. And Obama essentially invites this in his foreign policy, and white liberals do the same, right? Basically, you know, they used to say "love me, I'm a liberal," and now they say "hate me, I'm a liberal," or "I'm a white liberal," and it's just, you know, it's a sign of a lack of consciousness of personal freedom and integrity. You know, when you have nothing inside you, when you have no feelings, no sense of personal morality, apart from that which is dictated by the outside, then you're a fair game for those kinds of bitch slaps, right? The reason why they're administered is because they work. They wouldn't have worked 50 years back because it was a different country. They wouldn't work with me. They wouldn't work with you. I mean, we just find them ridiculous. But we're living in a country which is very different, and where, moreover, you can pay a real political cost if you stand up against common morality. I mean, you know, you and I both know people who work in private industry who, if their political opinions were known, they would be canned instantly.
Yes.
I mean, I'm speaking of Trump supporters, for example. So, you know, so they have to remain anonymous. And then we recall the story of Brendan Eich, however you pronounce it, the former CEO of Mozilla, who donated some money to the anti-gay marriage initiative and was summarily fired from his firm. So, you know, there's a degree of hatred and intolerance on the left, which now seems to have migrated over to the Never Trump crowd, right? It's just... It's really an angry nation, a nation of hatreds, dueling hatreds these times. The famous people I know are the Trump guys.
Can you get me inside the skin of these haters? If I, for example, if I were the CEO of a company and found that somebody had given to a political cause that I didn't share or even despised, it wouldn't even occur to me to let that person go, if, you know, assuming they're doing their job. And even if they weren't doing their job, I'd only let them go on the basis of that. I mean, put me inside the skin of these other folks.
Well, no, I mean, if I were the CEO of a company and I found out somebody was supporting Trump, would I fire the guy? Well, I'd sure think about it. Why? Because my primary mission is to defend my organization. And I don't want to be the subject of a boycott. So those guys do hatred and boycott and all that, and we don't. So they have that power, which we lack. So, you know, it's entirely rational when you know, it's from an economic.
Why don't our boycotts work?
I think we're too well-mannered. And our life is involved in things other than politics. I mean, we have a life. And many of these guys don't. And as I say, it's migrated to people to the Never Trump crowd, to many Republicans. They see their party being taken away from them. They don't like it. They see their power being taken away from them. They see their donors leaving them. And they're furious. And so they pick on, you know, really intemperate things said by Donald Trump, which we both regret. And they blow them out of all proportion, and they make this a litmus test. Either you now condemn Trump, or I will despise you for the rest of your life. That's what you get from some of these people. Yeah.
Well, I was just appalled at what Hollande said in France. And it seems to me that the entire political class has become ill-mannered, and you know, they've lost the gentlemanly. They don't fight according to what's the famous phrase about boxing?
No hitting under the belt.
Well, there's a set of rules about boxing that has an English name.
No, Queensbury.
Queensbury. The Queensbury rules have gone out the window completely, and it really has created a kind of public stupidity. The issues are not being discussed with any level of focus on the issues or focus on what really matters.
Well, I can't exactly say that my guy Trump plays by Queensbury's rules.
Fair enough.
But nobody much is. And when you look at things that some Republicans have been saying about Trump, they're much more intemperate in many cases. They're much more vicious than anything he's ever said. I mean, some of their comments are just laced with a fury that's one doesn't see in Trump. So
we should all be investing in
expanding to complain.
We should all be investing in whatever company owns Rolaids right now, because they're probably selling more than ever. So we're now less than 100 days out, aren't we, from the election? And it's my opinion that we're going to see a very bumpy period of polling going up and down and around, and it's going to depend a lot on whatever issues or events dominate the voters' mind and imagination in the last few weeks before the election. You think that's accurate?
I think that's fair enough. I mean, look, it's August. We're 95 days out or so. Don't pay much attention to the polls. Pay attention to a couple of things. Number one, it's important that Trump do a pivot back to policy. You're not going to see any defections at Trump headquarters. It's also important that he try to make nice to some Republican politicians, notably Kasich in Ohio. Ohio is a must-win state. Kasich is the party in Ohio has not been supporting Trump. Party officers in Pennsylvania are similarly sitting on their hands. So he's got to win over some of the established figures. He's got to reach out to them. Cruz yesterday said he's going to vote for Trump.
Good for him.
These people are.
I mean, that took him. He had to swallow hard to do that, but good for him.
Yeah, but, you know, however unamiable he might be, he's a smart guy, so he knew he had to do it. He had to do it for a couple of reasons, and one of them was he bloated his coffee book at the convention, but the other thing is Trump's there, and there are a whole bunch of Trump voters. And, you know, and while he upset many people amongst his friends with his speech, More importantly, he also upset many millions of Americans who like Trump.
Yeah, and he's going to have some significant challengers in his own senatorial race.
Yeah.
So we should be...
So, you know what? So, it's fun and games. There's a line from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. that I like. He said, life is action and passion, and he who has not participated in the life of his day can be thought of as not having fully lived. So you and I were active in the action and passion of our day, and that in itself is a sufficient payoff.
It's true. It's nice to be engaged. I mean, it's satisfying to be engaged. And
yeah.
After all, I mean, as I wrote in my own book on happiness, the key is for your passion to be united with a purpose that is truly good and ultimately good.
Yeah, that's what the existentialists missed. They thought just being engagé was all that mattered, and it didn't matter which side you were on. That's
yeah, or what good you were seeking to achieve.
Right, and the better kind of existentialist, like Camus said, no, it's a little more complicated than that. Pick the right side.
and that, of course, lost him the friendship of Jean-Paul Sartre and the other nihilists of his... of his generation in France.
I would concede the desire for good results to everyone who pretty much with whom I disagree. So I think it's also important that we not go over to the craziness of the Never Trumpers or the craziness of extremists on either side, but regard them all with a certain sense of humor and, more importantly, detachment.
I remember, I think the first book that I ever read of yours was on the morality of laughter.
Yeah. Well,
so that is...
Laughter is very healthy. I mean, it was it's a God-given gift.
In 2 minutes, what is the importance, the moral importance of laughter?
Because laughter tells us about things we dare not speak. That there are people who are ridiculous and whom we should not emulate. And rather, we should try to emulate those people who have shown themselves not ridiculous. And those are honorable, decent people. But as for the cowards and the hypocrites, those guys, not only is it permitted to laugh at, but it's really good for you and it's a lot of fun as well.
Who or what taught you the most about the meaning of laughter?
Bergson wrote a little book called Le Rire, mm-hmm. Laughter,
yes.
Which I had to read in French 200 a long time ago. Bergson was a great figure, not
yes.
In Bergson.
That's the first book I read on laughter. But, you know, I think the person who's taught me the most about laughter since then is Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
Just watching how he worked through his two-reeler days up to his feature film days.
Wow.
He's just a genius at it.
I wrote to people about laughter. John Cleese told me this that I hadn't realized, that the key is timing, and that seems to me to be absolutely right. Look at a good comedian and get onto YouTube and take a look at people in Johnny Carson back when, and it's all timing. And
his reaction to the famous tomahawk throw.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, it was his reaction and sequence of reaction to that kept that laughter going for 3 or 4 minutes.
Right.
And no one since Carson on Late Night has had anything like the timing
right.
He had.
You could read a transcript of what was said and it wouldn't be funny. And then you watch it and it's hilarious. And that's the difference between a good comedian and a bad one. And it's timing is as important as anything.
Frank Buckley, who is a foundation professor at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. Thanks again for being my guest today on Church and Culture.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's always a delight.
We'll have you back soon to talk about more current events. Those of you who are listening, please stay with me. We have another great guest right after this short message.
Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews when I interview the people who are engaged in remarkable ministries that are making a real difference in their parishes and the world. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
A few years back, a nationally known television show did an exposé on spanking. They placed a camera in three families' homes for approximately 2 weeks and let the camera run, attempting to catch these families in the act of spanking, to show you how awful this particular parenting practice was. Well, as usual, it was a hyper-sensationalized portrayal, not even-handed. The parent that they interviewed most was a mean-spirited lady. She swung first, she asked questions later, she pushed, she yelled, she screamed, she nagged, she was erratic. There was much that could be improved in her parenting. The fact that she spanked erratically was, I think, only one of her problems. Of course, that's who they used to represent you folks, or anyone who does spank. At the end of the show, they said something that I think captures the hysteria surrounding spanking. They said, "We are well aware that many parents still spank their children, so we asked our experts. Our experts said, if you spanked your children growing up and they turned out okay, that doesn't mean you were a good parent. You were probably just lucky. Consider the implication. Everything you've done over 20 years, pouring your heart and soul into creating the most decent human being you can be undone if you had an occasion to accidentally or deliberately squat a bottom. It's such awful psychological evil." I'm Dr. Ray.
Here's a history lesson for you today, one you might find chilling. On July 4th, 1826, America awaited a special moment. It was the young nation's jubilee, its 50th anniversary, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, a grand triumph for humanity. But particularly touching was how Americans solemnly awaited dramatic news of whether the Declaration's chief architects, the elderly Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, would survive. They both died that exact date. But here's something you surely never learned in history class. On that same glorious date, an English socialist transplanted to American soil issued a bold proclamation. On that July 4th, 1826, Robert Owen stood atop an ideological colony he fashioned in his own image in New Harmony, Indiana, and delivered his Declaration of Mental Independence. "I now declare to you and to the world," proclaimed Owen, "that man up to this hour has been a slave to a trinity of the most monstrous evils inflicted upon the whole race. I refer to private property and absurd and irrational systems of religion and marriage." Wow. Private property, religion, marriage. Robert Owen's unholy trinity. The Stoic socialist called for a revolution to deliver mankind from this hydra of evils. Owen's acolytes began their civilization by scrapping the Christian Anno Domini calendar, marking 1826 as the new year one. They adored the collective, and they abhorred the individual. Thus, he declared, "I have bought this property." He bought the property to plot his fundamental transformation. And like so many champions of progress to come, he knew that such revolutionary change could not be accomplished at once.